Okay, hi everybody. This is Tony Marcolini. I'm joined today with my sidekick and friend Seamus McDonough for another episode, if it may interest you to know. Today we have a special guest with us, acclaimed historian, author. I'm sure you've read one of his books because he's got a number of them out there. Harlow Giles Unger. And yeah, I was nervous about getting the pronunciation wrong. I hope I did it right. So welcome, Mr. Unger.
Thank you very much. Very nice to be here.
So I think I first thought of wanting to have you on the podcast. Anyone who does listen to us knows I'm pretty much a rabid reader. And I had read your book, Lion of Liberty, about Patrick Henry, and I really enjoyed it. I mean, I think it was the best historical recount I have ever read anywhere of his life. And it excited me so much because I'm a history buff as well. And it's really hard to find other people who enjoy history as much as I do. So when I get a really good book and a passionate writer who retells the story, you really capture me. I've since read Lafayette, which I thought Lion of Liberty was my favorite of yours. And now I have to say that Lafayette has bumped it out of the front runner. But let me talk a little bit about Lion of Liberty first. I mean, I always think of, and I think most people think of Patrick Henry from their, you know, seventh grade history classes. Give me liberty or give me death. And, you know, that early phrase, but they don't really understand how complex a man he was and about his life. What got you interested in Patrick Henry?
Of course, you've touched on one of the problems in the study of history, and I think it's true of all nations, not just of the United States, but when you're teaching history, and remember, our history is relatively short compared to the histories of France or Italy or European countries. You're trying to compress more than 200 years in a few hundred pages to be read over 20 weeks or so. And that's just impossible. So the best of historians do not write textbooks for kids for that very reason, because you just cannot tell the entire story. And so most of these characters, great characters, come across as postage stamps with give me liberty or give me death. That's what he said. That's all he is. And here is one of the most complex figures in the history of the Americas. A true story of that time of a rags to riches in both the intellectual and political sense. He was a farm boy from the hills of Virginia. Nowhere. He could hardly get to where his father's farm was in the Piedmont Hills of really west central Virginia. He just grew up like any farm boy. He probably learned some basic reading and writing in those days. If there was a church nearby, the churchman would teach kids, if the parents wanted, would teach the kids to read and write. And usually if it was a boy, it was essential that the boy learn to read and write, because he would have to help his father take whatever they grew, whatever product they grew, to market and bargain in terms of prices, make sure that they got what they were supposed to get, and purchase whatever they needed. So these basic skills of what we would call household affairs, you had to learn a certain level of reading and writing. And that's what he did. And as he grew up, his father, there were no towns in rural Virginia or the rural states. There were crossroads. The road into one man's farm led to a dirt road where another man's farm, the road would empty into that dirt road, and that dirt road would eventually end up at a town with lots of farms emptying onto that road. And at one of those crossroads, somebody would build a church. And it would just be called Church Corner. It would have no names. There were no towns as such. If the Church Corner drew enough people, well, some traveling merchant would be wise enough to come there on Sundays and try to sell his goods after church meeting. And if there were enough people there, some local would be wise enough to set up a little shack and serve a little liquor to the people after church. And that's what happened at the Church Corner where Patrick Henry lived. A church went up, and his father, who was quite an enterprising man, built a small tavern. And like many, many kids in the country, to this day in rural areas, I lived out in Wyoming for a while, and loads of kids learn to play the fiddle. They can't read a note of music, but they learn to play the fiddle by ear. And they're terrific. Some of these kids, you just wouldn't believe it. If you have access to YouTube, you can hear a few of them. They'll be playing the banjo, or they'll be playing the fiddle, or they'll form little bands for a few years. And then they go about their business. They don't make livings out of it, but they are absolutely terrific. And Patrick Henry was terrific. And in introducing each of the songs, he would tell stories and became quite a speaker and a humorist. And then suddenly a guy comes in dressed to kill, and he tells Patrick Henry's father and the other farmers there that they need to pay taxes. They have to pay higher taxes this year because the price of tobacco fell. And in those days in Virginia, you paid taxes in the form of tobacco. And if the price of tobacco fell, you'd still have to pay the high price. If it went up, you'd have to pay less tobacco. Well, tobacco really collapsed one year, and the farmer, Patrick Henry, stopped his fiddle and started talking to the farmers and got them angry. Well, he didn't know much about law, so he got to Richmond, which was the capital of the state, and went to a library and started studying law on his own. Learned a lot about it, started practicing in the woods outside his home, speaking, giving talks. He'd read from the law books and talk to the trees. was gifted, and he started acting. And eventually he goes to court on behalf of convinces these farmers to let him go to court to sue the Church of England, the most powerful church in the English Empire. He had the place in tears. He was gesticulating. He would talk to the heavens. He was the greatest actor on stage they had ever seen. And he won the case. They carried him out on their arms and cheered him and just danced around the crossroads with him on their shoulders, cheering him. It was the greatest victory. It's still in the law books and the history of the United States. The case was called the Parson's Cause, because the parson sued the taxpayers and the taxpayers won. So from then on, the taxes were set at a reasonable level in terms of currency rather than the price of tobacco. So that calmed things down for a while, but that was the start of his anger against authority and against centralized authority. Well, fast forward, we get the Boston Tea Party, we get all the action up in Boston, and there again, it's a matter of taxes. Suddenly, because the original deal between the settlers and the crown was that they would cross the ocean, settle barren land, claim the land as their own, clear it and work it and plant it. And they would, whatever they planted, they would have to sell to merchants in England. They couldn't sell it to other countries. had to sell it to English merchants, and they could keep all they made, all their profits, no taxes. That was the deal. And so after the Mayflower, other settlers came in. Some went down to Virginia. They planted tobacco, and they had paid no taxes. Some of them were smart enough to buy more and more land. Patrick Henry's father was not that smart. His was a relatively modest farm. George Washington's older brother was very smart. He had a tobacco farm in Mount Vernon, Virginia, along the Potomac River, closer to what is now Washington, D.C. And he expanded it until he had thousands of acres. And it was one of the richest tobacco plantations in America at the time of the Revolution. By then, Washington had taken over the plantation, and his response to British efforts to tax was, "They have no right to put their hands in my pocket." And that's a quote from George Washington, direct quote, famous quote of his. What had happened was that Britain had fought France for years. They had fought a 100 years war or centuries earlier, and now they had fought a 7 years war from 1756 to 1763, and it had bankrupted both nations. They fought it on the seas. They fought it in India, in Africa, in Europe. Seven nations joined in. It was actually what became the first world war of sorts. And it bankrupted both nations. France started taxing their people. Britain started taxing the farmers in Britain, and the farmers rioted. So Parliament had to back down. Meanwhile, all these rich folk in the colonies were not paying any taxes. And they sent over tax collectors. And as I say, these fancy guys in fancy suits started walking on the farms. The farmers rebelled. And in Massachusetts, in Boston, they waited for a load of British tea to come, and they dumped all the tea overboard. That was the famous Boston Tea Party. And that action excited others along the coast. There were tea parties after the Boston one. There was a tea party in New York, in Philadelphia, in Charleston, Virginia, South Carolina, Savannah, Georgia. All the ports had tea parties. Boston had a second tea party, which isn't as famous as the first one, but that set off insurrections in all the major port cities. The word got inland, and farmers stopped paying their taxes. And there was a threat of the British troops taking over the House of Burgesses, which was the legislature of the state of Virginia, which was then in the capital of Williamsburg. The members of the legislature, the Burgesses, fled to Richmond. By then, Patrick Henry had been elected a Burgess from his district, and it was in Richmond that he gave his famous speech. Our brethren are already at war in Boston. Why are we doing nothing here? And he aroused them to take up arms, and that was really the sounding, the bell tolled for the War of Independence.
Well, I think that's one of the things that surprised me most. Could you kind of credit in your book? You'll say, well, you know, George Washington was the military guy, or, you know, we certainly have Jefferson, who was the writer, you know, of getting the documents together. But Patrick Henry was the ignition switch, right? Yeah. That's kind of how you couch it in the book. And I never realized that. I mean, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but to me, my interpretation of what you read was that without him, you almost wonder if it ever happens. Like he's the guy who gets everybody, you know, involved. He's the passion that moves the revolution along.
Yeah, I think it's always dangerous to cite one person as without him, this great event would not have happened. You know, I think we would have won the Second World War without Churchill, without Eisenhower. Someone else, others would have arisen. They had the opportunity and they seized it. He had the opportunity in the House of Burgesses, where all these, he was a common man. He had stirred up the House of Burgesses when he first entered, when it was in Williamsburg. And he walked in farmer's clothes. And all these other Virginia Burgesses were plantation owners, and they were out-Britishing the British in terms of noble behavior and yeah. beautiful dress and clothes and everything. And this farmer walks in dirty clothes, dirty hands, and they were appalled. And so he always had them sitting back, shocked. And when they finally had to flee Williamsburg and they landed in Richmond, and the only meeting place was St. John's Church up on the hill in Richmond, and they were hemming and hawing as British parliamentarians do. Well, and no one says anything. They make noises. And Patrick Henry had enough and he stood up. And by then he really was a great actor, great orator, and had them on the floor. He literally had them on the floor. They do a reenactment of it at St. John's Church every summer, a weekly reenactment. And it's still thrilling. It is still thrilling in that setting. There is a solemn setting, and you can just picture this man standing up and just absolutely rousing these people to go to war and to defend their homes. It was a thriller. I think probably someone else could have and would have done it. He was the first to stand up and do it. Remember, up in Boston, they had already gone to war. In Boston, Samuel Adams and John Hancock had already led a revolution. They had to flee Boston, and the troops went after them and massacred a group of farmers, which historians began calling Minutemen, because they had rifles at their hands at the minute, ready to take up arms. And they massacred, I've forgotten whether it was 9 or 10 or 11 of these farmers and their kids, their sons, on the green at Lexington. And that's the beginning of the first warfare. The Minutemen retreated to Concord. The British troops went after them, having heard that there was a supply of arms and ammunition, rebel arms and ammunition in Concord. So they set out to search for it. But by the time they got to Concord, the word had gotten out from farmer to farmer to farmer to farmer, and thousands of farmers now gathered in Concord behind stone walls along the road and along the square in Concord. So they were ready for the British troops when they got there, and started massacring the British troops. British troops had to flee along the road, and they killed hundreds of British troops retreating back to Boston. And that was the beginning of the actual warfare in the War of Independence.
Well, can you talk a little bit about Patrick Henry's impact on the Bill of Rights?
Now, that's much later, of course. That's after the Constitution had been passed, and the Bill of Rights being the first 10 amendments to the Bill of Rights. This is afterwards. By then, he had fought against ratification of the Constitution. He was the original anti-federalist, as it was called. After the experience during the War of Independence, Congress did not have the power to tax. Congress did not have the power to raise troops. Congress, in effect, had no powers at all. It was a place where representatives, for the first time in history, representatives from each of the independent provinces of England in America, and they were each independent provinces. They had nothing to do with each other. They didn't trade with each other. The only place they could trade was send their stuff back to England. So they had no contact with each other. They didn't know each other. or meet each other until it was called the First Continental Congress. And then in the Second Continental Congress, which was held in the fall of 1775, the Second Continental Congress in the spring of 1776 is where they actually declared independence and created a what was first called a federation, not a union, but a federation. Each of the former provinces, now states, was independent of the others and governed itself so that the Congress had almost no powers at all. It couldn't raise an army, it couldn't tax anybody, so it couldn't raise any money. And Washington had to plead with the governors of each state to send troops under their own flags and to pay them. Well, they couldn't do it. So at first it was a losing battle, and Washington's troops were run out of Massachusetts, out of New York, across New Jersey. It was a just a terrible, terrible, humiliating defeat for the Americans. And they finally retreated across the Delaware River, fled across New Jersey, across the Delaware River into Pennsylvania, opposite Trenton. And Washington had the foresight to tell his troops to seize any boats, canoes, anything they saw on the east bank of the Delaware so that the British troops couldn't just sail across and follow them. So that gave him and his troops a little breathing time. But at that point, the war seemed lost. There weren't enough troops. Many had deserted by then because of the defeats. Many of them didn't have enough clothes. They were freezing cold. Many did not have food. They were hungry and starving. So it was the end of the revolution by then, and there was nothing anyone could do. Congress was helpless. It had no powers, and the governors just weren't acting very formidably to help. It was a writer, a polemicist, Thomas Paine, who came to Washington's help and wrote a document called The American Crisis, and he later numbered it number one because he eventually wrote 31 American Crises. And
you actually write another book about Thomas Paine, right? Isn't that?
Yes. That is out on the market, Thomas Paine.
That's your new book, correct?
Yeah, that's my newest book. Unfortunately, it came out just as the pandemic struck. Bookstores closed and the book business fell apart. But it's doing as well as can be expected under the circumstances.
Well, I mean,
that lifted the spirit of the troops, and during a snowstorm on Christmas night, they sailed across the Potomac, across the Delaware River, to Trenton, and caught the troops in Trenton. They were Hessian troops by surprise. At dawn, it was snowing. They had celebrated Christmas night with a big banquet and lots of drink. So they were oversleeping and they were caught in bed. And they came out in their nightshirts to try to defend themselves. But the Americans won the day in Trenton. And that lifted spirits up among Americans. That was the first true victory that American troops had over the British Army.
Well, I mean, I personally loved this book. I mean, I think it's very much worth the read, especially if you're a history buff. And even if you're not a history buff, I mean, this is a very compelling man and an orator. I mean, his story, his life story is fascinating to read.
We don't really tell the story of anti-federalism and how strong it was, because eventually anti-federalism led to the Civil War. And Patrick Henry is the father of anti-federalism. When they were writing the Constitution, each state had to ratify the Constitution. Congress did not ratify the Constitution. Congress had no power. each state had to ratify it. And at the debate over ratification in Virginia, he warned Virginians that the Constitution puts all the nation's money in the president's hands, puts control of the troops, the army in the president's hands. What else does he need to become a tyrant? He has the money, he has the troops. He can dictate to the country. So he voted against ratification of the Constitution. Unlike other Southerners at the time, who later preferred trying to divide, to split the nation and went to declare a civil war, Henry, who was a had become a close friend of Washington, respected Washington's views, and Washington's argument was, we can always change the Constitution, we can always write new amendments and modify it. So Patrick Henry voted against ratification, but when he lost the vote, he and many of his followers wanted to start another war. They were ready to start a civil war right then and there and secede. He put that down and said, I will be a loyal citizen and try to change the Constitution by constitutional means. So he put down the first hint of civil war.
And he fought hard for the Bill of Rights, right? He fought hard to get certain basic human rights protected. That was important to him.
Well, that was the first step on what he thought would be the road back. But it didn't really strip the federal government of what he felt were dictatorial powers. And in that day and age, they could have become dictatorial powers much more than in today's world, where we have a huge body of extra constitutional jurisprudence. We have bodies of laws, both federal laws and state laws, that mitigate against the possibility of a takeover by a centralized dictator in Washington. There are just too many laws on the books and too many amendments to the Constitution to prevent that. And indeed, it has gone so far that many people today are afraid that that states' rights have become so powerful, they may strip the people in various states of their constitutional rights. Many states in the South and the Midwest are imposing voting restrictions now that will limit voting rights. Texas has just passed a law to try to strip women of their rights to abortion. And the states may have gotten too powerful. Whether we'll swing back, I don't know.
And what would Patrick Henry say, do you think?
Patrick Henry would be, one of the most famous speeches he gave cried out, why not give them the right to vote? You know, I mean, he would be apoplectic at what the Southern states are doing to try to restrict voting rights. He believed in freedom of the individual, not freedom of state governors.
Right. Well, I'm sorry that we don't have time to get into every one of your books because they're all brilliant.
There are 30 of them.
They're all, I mean, you're a true historian. When I was reading Lafayette, you apparently went to France to actually do a great deal of the research for that. Is that common? Do you usually travel to do your research?
Oh, absolutely. And I did the research for most of my early books before the internet. Well, there was an internet, but now you can get every manuscript in the National Library in Paris, or in the Oxford Library, Oxford University Library, or Cambridge University Library, any of the great libraries in the world. You can just click on your, you don't have to get up from your desk. You can get it right on your own screen. That was not possible yet. And the internet was primarily a means of telecommunications in a sense, but it wasn't what we have today. And so I had to travel to all these places to study original manuscripts and get old out of print books from the times of the figures I wrote about. And that made it much more fun. Believe me, that is much more fun. It's much more fun having breakfast in a nice hotel in Paris and taking the metro to the National Library at lunchtime, going to a nice bistro for lunch.
And it makes for a lot better story, too.
And just sitting at your desk and having a ham and cheese sandwich and seeing nobody. Seeing nobody. It's a very, very lonely job writing a book where you're just going to be at your desk the whole.
Well, for sure. I mean, for certain, I agree.
Books, you can see, which I would not have to collect nowadays. I could get them all on the internet, keep them all on file in the cloud, and not have a single book. And those books are all double, in some cases, triple shelved. Those are books behind the books.
Yeah. I too have a lot of books still. I have to admit, I've transferred over to the Nook, not to have my house completely overrun with books. I do buy ebooks instead. But I still have my collection from all the years of reading books.
Well, you can't throw them out. And number one, number two, because it's a big, huge investment. But number two, I know where to find the information, where to go. Exactly. In any one of my books, I'm sure you know as well as I do, you ask a question on the often ask a question on the internet, and you get the answer for a question you didn't even ask.
Yeah.
I have no idea why that happens. You ask a simple question, and you get the answer for something you didn't even ask about.
Well, it's a machine, not a person, right? It's a machine trying to...
That's its only defense. That's the only reason my fist hasn't gone through the screen.
It gets to hide behind that. Well, I would love to... I really love to have you come back. I didn't get a chance. Really only got through Lion of Liberty, which I know was the reason you were appearing today. That was... I'd first read the book and finished it and said, oh, I have to have him on to talk about the book. I fell in love with it. But now, like I said, I've since read Lafayette, and I think I like it more. And I wish, we had the opportunity and the time to go through that book. That's an even
Lafayette's a wonder. Yeah, Lafayette's a wonderful story, and that took me all through France. I as a child, I grew up in France, so I'm bilingual. So I love doing Lafayette.
On that note, I'm going to say thank you so much, Mr. Unger,
thank
for
joining
us. And we'll have him back. We'll have him back very soon, everybody.
Thank you, Harlow.
Bye.